Pleasure to introduce our speakers. I'm going to introduce all the speakers before each center gives their talk. In most cases, we have several speakers presenting on behalf of a center. Full bios for each speaker are available on the CLUEN webinar page, so I encourage you to have a look. They're pretty distinguished scientists. We'll start with Dr. Carolyn Mattingly, the principal investigator of the North Carolina State Superfund Research Program Center, Environmental and Human Health Effects of PFAS, and director of the center's administrative core. Dr. Mattingly is a professor and head in the Department of Biological Science at NC State. Her research program focuses on understanding the effects of environmental exposures on human health. She is also the PI of the Comparative Toxicogenomics Database, ctdbase.org, which is a publicly available resource that integrates information about chemicals, genes, phenotypes, diseases, and exposure data. Dr. David Reif is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences and a resident member of the Bioinformatics Research Center at NC State. He is the director of the Data Management and Analysis Corps, DMAC, of the NC State SRP Center. Reif is also the director of the Bioinformatics Consulting and Service Corps and co-director of the Integrated Health Services Faculty Corps of the NC State Center for Human Health and the Environment. And finally, I will introduce Dr. Jamie DeWitt. She is an associate professor in the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology of the Brody School of Medicine at East Carolina University and an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University. In addition to serving as the research translation coordinator for the Center for NC State, she also leads a project focused on uncovering mechanisms associated with immune suppression induced by PFAS exposure. So Dr. Mattingly, I'm going to turn this over to you now. Okay. Can you hear me okay? Yes. Okay. Great. Well, thank you, Michelle, and hi, everybody, virtually. We're very excited to be part of the Superfund program, and I should start off with the caveat that we are a new center, and a new center that got launched right at the beginning of the pandemic. So we've had an interesting start to our history. So I'm sure everybody has had a challenging year, so we're not alone. So as Michelle said, the name of our center is the Center for Environmental and Health Effects of PFAS. So for those of you that are not familiar with PFAS, they comprise approximately 5,000 known compounds, and their properties have been harnessed to make a wide variety of different sorts of products, from consumer products, cookware, to industrial products, based on their water, stain, and grease-resistant properties. They're resistant to degradation, and they move easily throughout the environment, and so there's concern about their accumulation in living organisms and their half-life. And although they're becoming known to be ubiquitous worldwide, unfortunately, we don't know a lot about the exposure and the human health effects of these compounds. So over the last few years, North Carolina has had the inauspicious attention brought to it as a result of some incidences related to PFAS. And this attention has focused primarily on the Cape Fear River watershed, which I'm showing you here. This is the largest watershed in North Carolina, and it supplies drinking water for about 1.5 million people in North Carolina. So a little bit about the history behind this. So in 1980, fluorochemical production began at DuPont's Fayetteville Works, also known as Chemours. I'm sorry, getting used to the advancing here. So in 2002, production began at the Chemours plant for PFOA, or perfluorooctanoic acid, shown here. In 2007, the first publication that came out from work out of Mark Striner and Andy Lindstrom's labs, who I'm sure many on this call are familiar with, indicated that PFAS were detected in the Cape Fear River Basin. This was one of the initial attention-drawing findings to this area. In 2009, an EPA consent order allowed for conditions of replacing PFOA with another compound called GenX, and at the same time, EPA issued provisional health advisories for PFOA and PFAS, shown here. Over the next few years, a lot of research continued to be done, and it was shown that GenX, this replacement compound, was also found in the Cape Fear River, and work was continuing to be done on fluoroether structures, of which GenX is one. So a lot of emerging understanding about the diversity of these fluorochemicals, and particularly fluoroethers. In 2016, another paper that was published as well by Mark and Andy also included Detlef Kanape, who is the deputy director of our center. And this report showed that there were high levels of PFAS, including these fluoroethers, in the drinking water in this area. In 2017 and 18, in response to an NIEHS time-sensitive research opportunity, Dr. Jane Hoppen at NC State, in collaboration with David Collier and some other folks at East Carolina University, put in an R21 proposal to try to answer the question about if GenX was being found in high levels in the river, what does this look like in terms of the human population surrounding this river. So as this work was starting to be done, a number of us at NC State started talking about whether or not we should put in a Superfund proposal. And given the variety of expertise across the engineering and biology programs at NC State, as well as clinical and other PFAS expertise at ECU, we got together and in 2018 put in a proposal for a Superfund project. So as I'm sure you are all aware, we waited and we're very excited in February 2020 to learn that we were going to be funded for a project. And we were funded with some pretty significant cuts, but I know others have as well. And we thought, well, if we can get through that, that would be our biggest challenge. And then, of course, March came and COVID happened. So that resulted in a shutdown of a lot of the laboratories and field work that we had planned. But as it turned out, I think, you know, we made the most of this time, and it was a good planning process. And since then, things have alleviated in terms of constraints in the lab, and we've been ramping up as best we can since that time. So I'm going to go through the structure of our center, and I'm going to turn it over at various points to David and Jamie to provide some additional details about our center. So overall, the goal of our center is to focus on advancing understanding about different aspects of PFAS. So specifically looking at exposure in North Carolina communities and the environment, looking at toxicity and the underlying mechanisms of specifically thyroid and immune function, the bioaccumulation potential of these compounds, and ultimately looking at remediation and how we can improve how we approach cleaning up PFAS-contaminated areas. So this is the structure of our center. Our administrative core is made up of me, Detlef Kanape, and Jamie DeWitt. We have 4 research projects, so 2 biomedical research projects and 2 environmental science and engineering. We have our required community engagement training core, and we are among the first group of centers that have the data management and analysis core. So we're excited to talk to you about how we're approaching that. In addition, we have 1 research support core, which we call CAPTURE, and this is essentially a very broad-based analytical core. We'll get into some more details about that shortly. So the administrative core, so essentially, I think very similar to other centers, our goal is to basically administrate the interactions and fiscal management of the center to make sure that the project cores and community engagement aspects are integrated and to facilitate translation of center discoveries to our stakeholders. So one of the things we were able to spend time on over the summer were to put in administrative supplement. And here's our website. So if you want the gory details of a lot of the things that are going on in our center, details about the members of our centers, you can check out our website there. So as I mentioned, we applied for 2 supplements, which we were successful in getting funded for. So that was very exciting. So one of them, we don't have a lot of time today, obviously, so I'll just give you a quick overview of what they are focused on. So the first supplement was in response to a notice of special interest on environmental exposure and COVID issued by NIEHS. And Jane Hoppen is essentially the driver of this supplement. And the purpose of this is to tap into the communities that she's already been working with in an epidemiological study and to look at and characterize disease symptoms related to some of the folks in those communities that have been exposed to PFAS through drinking water and look if there are correlations to response or severity of COVID disease. In the second supplement, this supplement was just a typical administrative supplement and really aimed to expand on the original aims of our parent grant, and specifically to expand the populations that were included in that study, so to include individuals upriver from Fayetteville in a town called Pittsburgh. We also aim to expand the analytical capabilities to measure total organic fluorine in the variety of samples that we'll tell you about, and also to demonstrate feasibility. We have a number of field studies, so looking at ways we can have blood collection methods that are more amenable to field studies. So those will probably make a little bit more sense as you hear more about the individual projects. So at this point, I will turn it over to Jamie DeWitt to tell you about the research translation aspects of the project as well as the 2 biomedical projects. Jamie?
Hello. Michelle, could you confirm that you can hear me?
I confirm I can hear you.
Thank you so much. Well, hello, everybody, and thank you for signing in to listen to these update talks. I'm going to tell you a little bit about our research translation efforts, and then I'll talk a little bit about projects 1 and 2. I wanted to highlight that Dr. Mattingly is helping to plan the 3rd National Conference on Per- and Polyfluoroalkyl Substances. This is a conference that has occurred twice in the past, and this is a very different conference from typical scientific conferences because it brings together scientists and regulators as well as community members. So this conference will be very much focused on those who are impacted by PFAS in their drinking water, in their communities, in their families. So it's a very emotional meeting compared to other types of scientific meetings. This one will be in June of 2022. We were hoping that it would be in June of 2021, but this is not the type of meeting that will really do well on a virtual platform. So keep your eyes open for that because it's really an amazing opportunity to find out how the chemicals we study are really impacting the people who are exposed to them on a real-time basis. In terms of research translation, as you all know, the model for research translation under the funding award has shifted a little bit. But I've really looked at this as an opportunity to do something a little bit different for our center. I've been meeting with other center coordinators, and because we're all used to a virtual world now, it's been really nice to interact with other research translation coordinators over a virtual platform. Those coordinators that I've met with so far are from University of Rhode Island, Duke University, and the University of Arizona, and those research translation coordinators have been really instrumental in helping us to plan our research translation efforts. We also are part of the monthly RTC CEC calls held by the SRP staff. We are also involved in a monthly call with other Superfund centers here in the state of North Carolina with respect to their CECs and RTCs. And I also have an ongoing monthly call with our community engagement coordinator, Katie May, so that we can ensure that the research translation that we do is closely tied to community needs as well as to the stakeholders on the state and federal level. In terms of project number one, as Dr. Mattingly mentioned, this is an extension of an R21 that Jane Hoppin had funded several years ago. And the goal of this project is to really dive a little bit more deeply into the potential health effects associated with PFAS that have been found in the Cape Fear River and in the drinking water. So she and Dr. Collier are leading this particular project, and they're really going to try to address community concerns. Now, certainly they can't address every single concern, but they have regular meetings with community members and organizations to better understand what health effects people are worried about and how their project can help them better understand the potential for PFAS to affect their health. So they really want to characterize exposure and better understand what types of PFAS are in people's bodies. Right now, they're looking predominantly at different types of PFAS in people's blood, but there may be some plans to expand that to other types of biological fluids. And then they're going to be looking at thyroid outcomes. And thyroid hormone and thyroid disease are two of those outcomes that have been associated with PFAS exposure in other epidemiological studies. So Dr. Hoppin's team is going to better understand how PFAS might be affecting thyroid health outcomes in these different populations. The GenX exposure study did result in a publication. It was published in Environmental Health Perspectives, which is a journal of NIEHS. And what was really interesting about this publication, it included blood measurements from over 300 study participants in the Wilmington area study. And what they found is that some compounds that were detected in fairly low concentrations in the drinking water were detectable in the blood of study participants. This was a little bit surprising because we really weren't sure what we were going to see. So there are some concerns that some of the compounds in the water might be fairly bioaccumulative compared to some of the other compounds that are in higher concentrations in the water. What we also found is that levels of some of the legacy PFAS, that is the PFAS that have been around for a little bit longer, such as PFOA and PFOS, were in higher concentrations in the blood of study participants compared to the general human population as measured by the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. We are still working, and Dr. Hoppin's team is still working to figure out those sources of exposure to the legacy compounds and why people in the Wilmington area have higher concentrations than other people in the United States. They've also expanded the study to ask questions about people living in different parts of the watershed, more upstream, and they're working with various organizations to ensure that the study population is diverse and representative of the people who use the water from this particular watershed. The project that I'm working on with Dr. Yoder and Dr. Coleman from NC State is looking at the immune effects of PFAS. One of the epidemiological findings that has been supported by findings in experimental animals is immune suppression. And that's one of the reasons that we're asking questions about COVID through Dr. Hoppin's project as well. There's some concern that exposure to PFAS reduces the ability of the immune system to produce antibodies. So there are some concerns that COVID infections might be more frequent or more severe in communities impacted by PFAS. There's also some concerns that if there is a vaccine, that people with high PFAS exposures won't be as able to develop appropriate vaccination responses, and so they still won't be as protected as other people with immune systems that aren't impacted by PFAS. So with this particular project, we're using a mouse model in my lab, and then in Dr. Yoder's lab, he's using a zebrafish model and a human cell line model to really ask some deep mechanistic questions about why the immune system is negatively impacted by PFAS exposure. Dr. Coleman is bringing his molecular level techniques to the group to help us better understand some of the pathways that could be impacted by PFAS, and we're specifically looking at those metabolic pathways that might be impacted by PFAS exposure. In terms of where we've gone, we've developed operating procedures and standardized and verified some of our approaches through pilot studies. Dr. Yoder has actually evaluated quite a suite of PFAS in the zebrafish model and in the cell line, and is starting to uncover some of those signals that might be related to structure of the PFAS so that we can better predict what other PFAS might be risks to the immune system. And with that, I'm going to hand things back over to Dr. Mattingly so that she can talk about Project 3 and Project 4.
Great. Thanks, Jenny. Okay, so I know time is short, so I'm going to jump in here. So Environmental Science and Engineering Project 3. So this is based on understanding that PFAS are stable in water and can travel over long distances. And so therefore, the impact of drinking water sources could be affecting both wildlife and human populations close or far from the source. So, and we're really not clear about the bioaccumulative potential of a lot of these compounds. So this project is being led by David Buckwalter, Tony Planchart, and Scott Belcher. And it's kind of broken out into an experimental and a field component. So in AIM-1, the study is going to establish an experimental model of trophic transfer and bioaccumulation. So we're going to sort of mimic the trophic transfer that may be occurring in the field, beginning with periphyton, which is this, forget how to use the little pointer here. Ah, there we go. Down here, which is consumed by mayflies, which is in turn consumed by zebrafish. So this team is going to be able to evaluate how each of these organisms respond to and potentially bioaccumulate different PFAS, both individually and in combination. So both through this dietary line, as well as through direct aquatic exposure. And so using the analytical core and DMAC, we'll be able to examine what sorts of accumulation levels we get with the different PFAS compounds that we'll be looking at. Then in addition, we'll be in AIM-2 assessing various biomarkers of both direct aquatic as well as dietary exposure. So looking at molecular, histological, and behavioral assays to determine whether this exposure through aquatic methods as well as dietary methods has differential effects on these biomarkers. And then at the same time, we'll have essentially parallel field studies that will be aiming to look at bioaccumulation of different PFAS in a variety of wild-caught aquatic animals at different trophic levels. And these animals will be procured within the Cape Fear River, so within the same water supplies that the human populations that were studying are also exposed to. And they're looking at both the biomagnification, and then in the field studies we have these larger animals that will give us the opportunity to look at whether there's preferential compartmentalization of different PFAS in these organisms. So in Project 4, we know that PFAS are not substantially removed by most of the conventional drinking water treatment processes. There's some promise to activated carbon, and this is one of the more widely used approaches. And the scale for these activated carbon filters can range from small point-of-use filters like Brita filters to large installations, more like what you see in this picture here. So while the engineering community knows that these activated carbon products can be used for the effective removal of some PFAS, it's not clear how well they scale for different kinds of compounds and the variety of compounds that we're detecting in the environment today. So in AIM-1, we're going to be using mass-labeled PFAS and isotope microscopy to determine the distribution of PFAS at equilibrium. And these data will tell us whether the current assumption that activated carbon interior is uniformly accessible. In AIM-2, we're going to study PFAS adsorption kinetics to develop better predictive models. And Detlef Kanape, who is leading this project, is on the call, I believe. So if there are more technical questions about that, he can provide some details for us. So there's been quite a bit of initial work done on this, and this is just an example of a proof of concept. So this slide is highlighting that isotope microscopy can detect oxygen 18 labeled perfluorohexane sulfonate in these activated carbon particles. So in the left panel where you see the green, yellow, and orange, that's showing where the PFAS has absorbed, and on the right panel is a control that was not exposed to PFAS. And so, again, this is just a proof of concept that we can use some of these models to look at and sort of optimize absorption of PFAS in activated carbon. And this work is being done in collaboration with Professor Matsui at Hokkaido University. So I will quickly move over to our cores. So our community engagement core is headed by Katie May. Sorry, can you hear me? I think somebody's
It sounded like we had just a little bit of background, Carolyn, but I think you're good.
Okay, no problem. Okay, so AIM-1 is really to leverage existing partnerships in the Cape Fear River Basin. So this is the area where Project 1 has been interacting with communities, and we have a lot of really strong partnerships with community groups, specifically the Haw River Assembly, Sustainable Sandhills, and the Cape Fear River Watch. And so our CEC is continuing to build these partnerships. In AIM-2, we've developed a number of different mechanisms to try to continue building environmental health literacy among the community. And rather than having it be NC State, ECU dictating this to the community, we've tried to develop programs such as the Fellows Program and mini grants to figure out how to get resources to the community so that they can be the drivers in what the best mechanism would be to interact with their broader community and disseminate information about PFAS. And as part of that, we're also fostering opportunities for research, the researchers that are part of our center, as well as the trainees, to get involved with these kinds of activities and working with impacted communities, and talk about that a little bit more in the RETC. Again, this is focusing on the groups in the same Cape Fear River Basin. And so far we've been working with them remotely, obviously trying to develop resource sharing methods. We're initiating a stakeholder advisory board with the plan of interacting with them hopefully in person in the future. And then coordinating with our RETSI training corps to ensure that our trainees have as many opportunities as possible to work with our community. So the RETSI is being led by Dr. Ranjithan, who's in our engineering program, and Dr. Planchart, who's in biological sciences here at NC State. And essentially, the goal of our RETSI is to cultivate cross-training and fluency across disciplines, technologies, and our communities. So we have very diverse expertise in our center from engineering and a lot of analytical and bioinformatic capabilities. So trying to ensure that our trainees are involved to the extent that they have fluency in each of these aspects, so they're not passing off their samples to an analytical core and not understanding anything about how those samples are being processed. So we've developed a number of strategies to try to do that. So one of them is through very intentional rotations, so our students will, even though they have assigned laboratories and their research projects have a particular focus, they will spend time in labs of very different disciplines that are complementary to their project so that they get some stronger literacy than just reading a paper on a technique, for example. We also are instituting nano courses. So these are like approximately 3-week courses that are in the various disciplines that touch our different projects. So for instance, mass spec techniques or bioinformatics techniques, and our students would be required to take a certain number of nano courses over their training period. We have cross-disciplinary seminars, so our engineering program as well as our toxicology program have seminars, and our trainees are required to attend seminars that are specific to topics relevant to our SRP, but may have more of an engineering flavor in one series versus toxicology flavor, so trying to get them to look outside of their comfort zone when it comes to attending seminars. And then finally engaging with the CEC and making sure there are lots of opportunities that they take advantage of both going into the community to help with community recruitment for Project One to having outreach and engagement activities that are being organized by Katie. So we'll do this through an individual development plan where the mentors of our trainees as well as the co-directors here of the RETSI will work with our trainees and make sure that they have a long-term plan for ensuring that they have the appropriate professional development as well as these cross-training experiences while they're working within our SRP program. So, okay. So I think I'm going to, and here's one last picture of our happy trainees. So we have, most of them are graduate students. We have a couple of postdocs. And some of these are funded explicitly through the SRP funding. Some are working on projects related to SRP funded through other NIH funds. And we did receive significant institutional support from NC State, as well as from ECU to help with supporting additional trainees. So we're really excited about having such a large group of students this early on, and we're trying to work really hard despite all of the distancing requirements to make sure that they have opportunities to work together and have a strong community. So I'm going to turn it over to David Rice, who will talk to you about the remainder of our course.
Hi. So please stop me if you can't hear me. And I think schedule-wise, we have a 5 minutes left maybe. Is that okay, Michelle?
Yeah, so we actually have to break at 2:45 for the next group. So just if you could maybe leave a couple minutes for questions and answers, that'd be great.
Yeah, let me do that, sure. Yeah, we'll go quick. So since these are going to be posted, I won't bother reading slides. We'll leave that information for people to read later. But I wanted to introduce one of our cores here, the Capture Core, which is bringing together expertise on omics, lipidomics, especially mass spec, analytical chemistry. They do theoretical and technological kind of engineering research. Aaron Baker, Dave Muddyman, and Jeff Enders at NC State. And I'm going to show on the next slide how there's really already a quite sophisticated structure in place with many elements. So there we go. So the capture actually composes three kind of big domains. And you can see how this is an example of kind of crossing the biomedical and environmental science and engineering portions of the center. And in particular, it's really the whole capture idea is set up to unite across those. And I think, you know, going along with the theme of integration. And I have a little screen cap here of a really nice project request tracking system that Capture set up. And what that does is it's a portal for folks to go in and ask information about any one of these domains. But I have a little highlighted section here that ties into our next couple of slides that I'll be presenting, where this theme of integration goes here too, where we're trying to inject DMAC consultation early in this process. So as you're filling out this request form, one of the things that kind of pings you and reminds you is, hey, it would be good if as you're designing your experiments or carrying out your analysis, you try to consult with the statisticians and experimental design folks in the DMAC as you're designing that stuff. So as the DMAC itself, not advancing, there we go, okay. So the DMAC, I'm director of it right now. It touches on a lot of parts of the center and includes a lot of people, but again, the theme is integration. So really our goal is to inject data science principles and tools early in the process so they can kind of flow through the entire thing. So you're not kind of left with the like, hey, wait, I need bioinformatics help now, my data are too big, those kinds of common questions. We capitalize on the strength of NCSU libraries to do some of this work as well. And I'm going to show you a concrete example of it instead of narrating it. One of the things we're doing is trying to build this browser that is along with one of our aims, and we're leveraging the bioinformatics capabilities here at NC State with the BCSC and the BRC as well, where we're building this modular tool where what folks can do within the center is as the data start arriving, you can find your way to data through a project or by data type or by tag or by a search, right? So this is really meant to reflect the way that people actually go searching for data in real life when maybe you're an expert and you know the taxonomy of something, maybe you know the ontology, maybe you go through Google, whatever it is. This is meant to be flexible, and this tagging idea is set up according to the data management plans that we set up and the comprehensive one, so that as data come in, they'll be tagged in different ways. And then, again, folks can find their way to those data according to what they need. But importantly, this will enforce data structures and allow us to spin off new analytics really quickly and also recreate integrative analysis. So you can pull data from many projects, come together, create something new, which is really, you know, again, the goal of our center is to be an integrated whole. So, you know, we're excited about this development. And in closing here, this is it's on our website. This is a figure of how things interact. There are more arrows than what are shown here, but I think what's important about it is that our research projects interact in many ways, and they both inform and reinforce each other. So we're really having to be nimble, especially with COVID stuff, as data arrive maybe at different rates than we had originally planned. And that's okay. We have our structure set up to handle that, and we should be able to pivot as needed. And as things sort of open back up, which is good news for everybody. So I'll close there and say on behalf of Carolyn and Jamie, I want to thank everyone for your attention, and we will welcome questions from the audience.
Thank you. So we did get a lot of questions, and I'm really hard-pressed to try to figure out which ones to choose. So you're likely going to have some people reaching out to you individually. We are short on time, so I'll just ask if you could maybe give us a quick answer, but still answer the question. The first question that came through was, can you share what levels of PFAS and Gen X were found during the various testing dates?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I'm not sure if the question is referring to the water samples or the human samples. Those have been published. So I'm not sure who asked the question, but if you wanted to drop me an email, we can point you to the papers. And if you had more questions about it, probably reaching out to Detlef or Jane Hoppen would get you more of the details you might be looking for.
Okay, sure. So we'll make sure that we connect you guys. The next question is, regarding the BioMed Project 2, do you see a rise in free radicals in the participants or lab animals? And can they be controlled somehow, or does PFAS inhibit that?
Hey, this is Jamie. I can answer that. So it really depends on what part of the immune system you're looking at. I don't think we've looked specifically in our project at any human samples. We'll be looking at cell lines. But free radicals are responsible for activation of some of the immune steps. So sometimes an increase in free radical production is beneficial. So for some of our immune assays, we're looking for changes in those oxidative radicals. But yes, in some of our animal models, we have seen increases in free radicals and oxidative stress.
Okay, thank you. And I'll ask one more question, just one that came through. Have you seen more legacy PFAS in top trophic levels like alligators?
Hey, this is Jamie. I'm happy to answer that okay. As well. Dr. Scott Belcher from NC State has been evaluating that, and he's seen very high concentrations of perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, or PFAS, in alligators. Some pretty high levels compared to other organisms that have been evaluated. Those data, I know he's published data for striped bass. I'm not sure if the alligator data have been published, but they have been presented at several scientific meetings. And that would be Dr. Scott Belcher.
All right. Thank you, Jamie. All right. So we have to move on to the next set of speakers. Next, we're going to hear from University of Iowa SRP Center. Dr. Carrie Hornbuckle is the director of the Iowa Superfund Research Program Center, or ISRP, and leads Project 4 and the ISRP Analytical Core. Her research includes large-scale field studies, development of novel sampling and analytical methods, and computational modeling to examine the sources, transport, and fate of persistent organic pollutants in indoor and outdoor environments. The second speaker we have for Iowa will be Dr. Hans Lemner. He is the Associate Director of the ISRP Center. He leads the airborne PCBs and their metabolites, risk factors for adverse neurodevelopmental outcomes in adolescents project, investigating the neurotoxicity of polychlorinated bisphenols in adolescents. He also leads the ISRP Synthesis Core, which provides quantities of PCBs and their metabolite available for a broad range of studies on the relaxation, transport, exposure, toxicity, and remediation of PCBs. As a full reminder, I didn't read all the bios, but they're available at the CLUIN webinar page, and I encourage you to have a look at that. So without further ado, Dr. Hornbuckle, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. Can you hear me all right?
I sure can.
Great. I'm not sure if I can see how to forward the slides. However, on my screen, it's not indicating a way to do that.
There should be a right arrow.
That it. Now it shows. Okay, super.
There we go.
Yes. So I'm the director of the Iowa Superfund Research Program. And the title of our center is Airborne PCBs, Sources, Exposures, Toxicity, and Remediation. We study polychlorinated biphenyls. So PCBs were popular because of their chemical stability, electrical insulating properties, and non-flammability. Although they are banned from sale nearly 40 years ago, PCBs as mixtures called aerochlores were used so extensively for so long it's not surprising they remain a persistent contaminant. Because of the effectiveness of the ban, PCBs are often called legacy pollutants. Unfortunately, the assumption that PCBs are no longer used is incorrect. Although PCBs are banned from sale, they are not banned from use, and they're still in use throughout the country in electrical equipment, sealants, caulking, and other materials used in buildings constructed between about 1930 and 1980. Furthermore, the assumption that PCBs are no longer produced is also incorrect. PCBs are produced as unintentional byproducts in many industrial processes. As a result, PCBs are found in some common household products. Our center has been a leader in the identification of PCBs in byproducts of modern chemical manufacturing. They are found in brightly colored paints and dyes, and most recently we reported their presence in polymer resins applied to wood finish. So our center has shown that PCB-containing building materials and consumer products are an important emission source in indoor air, including schoolrooms, and as major contributors to the inhalation exposure of children. Our center has clarified the importance of inhalation exposure. In fact, we found that inhalation is as important a route for some children's exposure as diet. Since our inception in 2006, our center has been interested in the lower molecular weight PCBs, partly because their toxicity was so understudied as research was focused on higher molecular weight compounds that were found in humans and animals and bioaccumulating. But the lower molecular weight compounds were not also not well understood because their prevalence in the environment was underestimated because methods used to detect PCBs had a difficult time identifying those with one or two chlorines, distinguishing them from noise in ECD detectors. As a result, there was a major gap in understanding of the importance of these compounds. However, all PCBs are semi-volatile, and each of the 209 conjugates can and does exist in the gas phase. So our center has always examined all the conjugates. PCBs are well studied, and several other SRP centers include them in their work. However, our center is the only one focusing on airborne PCBs. We chose this focus because our research discoveries have identified an important gap in knowledge and vital need for additional research that will reduce the important health risks associated with exposure to PCBs. These discoveries, of course, arrive with many more questions about sources, exposure, toxicity, and remediation. But this is a list of some of the major things, major discoveries, of findings of our center. We've shown that PCBs are complete carcinogens, that they disrupt the thyroid hormone system, that they disrupt adipocytes and energy homeostasis, that PCB metabolites are often more toxic than the parent compounds. We've also shown that contaminated waters, including Superfund sites, are major sources of airborne PCBs. We've shown that modern paint, polymers, as well as legacy building materials are major sources of airborne PCBs indoors. And as a result, PCB concentrations are often much higher indoors than outdoors, and schools are particularly notable because they were built to last, and so they embedded PCBs in the building materials up until the ban of aerosols in the 1970s. And as I mentioned before, we've shown that inhalation is a significant route for human exposure, and particularly for children because of the school situation. Overall, this is why we consider PCBs to present an issue of emerging concern because of the new understanding about the exposure route. So as a result, this diagram represents our view moving forward of our research. We are studying sources coming from surface waters that are have a reservoir of contaminated sediments. We're studying the releases from within school buildings. We're examining the inhalation exposure of the children relative to their dietary exposures in schools. We're focusing on adolescents. In fact, adolescents are an interesting group to study because of the tremendous hormonal changes occurring at that stage of life and the lack of understanding about how PCBs may be active during that vulnerable time. We're particularly interested in the role of metabolism and metabolites, as they indicate an important toxic risk to adolescents. And fourth, we're interested in prioritization of the most important contributors to human health risk in order to develop strategic decisions that consider both cost and health hazards on a congener-specific basis. So our center has three biomedical projects and two environmental engineering and science projects. And moving forward today, I've asked Professor Hans Lingler, the Deputy Director of the Iowa Superfund Research Program and project leader of one of the biomedical projects, to talk about these, and he'll also be available to answer any questions on these projects at the end. Hans.
Okay, hello everybody. Moving then on and talk about the three biomedical projects of the ISRP, and the first two that I'm going to talk about are actually new projects in the current funding cycle. So what I wanted to point to you is this diagram on the right side of the slides that, you know, has these columns. And what I really want you to point you to is at the bottom is the interactions that we have across the different projects. And for the project one and project two that I'm going to talk about first, really what has informed them is the research that we have done over the last several years, you know, looking at some of these non-aerochlor PCBs that are not in the technical mixtures that, you know, are turning out to be actually quite important because there is an exposure and we're learning that they have a toxic effect. And again, the focus here is, and this is driven by our external advisors, but then in particular also our audiences, and the schools certainly fall into this category, that we're actually looking at two important outcomes. This is in project one, neurotoxic outcomes during adolescence, and then looking in project two at metabolic syndrome as a toxic outcome. So as I indicated, you know, we're basing this on research that we've done over the last several years. And one of the things that is important about these airborne PCBs, they're metabolized. They're converted to hydroxylated metabolites, sulfates, and so forth. We don't really know much about their toxicities. So for example, we don't even know if hydroxylated PCBs are in the developing human brain. But we have data from rodent studies, and here's the little green arrow that shows you here the hydroxy PCB profiles in a little cartoon that we found in mice. What we've also shown is that there is a very significant difference in the metabolism of these compounds in humans versus in rodents, which has implications for how we're studying them. So again, you have this little metabolism scheme here, and actually this one where the arrow points to, this is actually the major human metabolite that one of our trainees found, whereas if you go in a rodent, this other metabolite is actually the major metabolite, and so this informed our thinking. We've actually just learned yesterday that the paper for the next bullet point was accepted. We actually have shown that inhalation to PCBs results in adverse behavioral outcomes in rats. This is the model we've adapted for these two laboratory-based biomedical projects. We know mechanistically they alter dopamine metabolism. And one of the other exciting discoveries we had, and this was the old project led by Mike Duffel, is there's an indication that actually, in particular, the metabolites are subject to metabolism in the brain, and that this local metabolism may actually be important for the toxicity of the metabolites of these airborne PCBs. So that informed our hypothesis that not only the parent compounds, but in particular their metabolites that are formed in humans, and that's really an emphasis of Project One, that they are actually in the brain and that they ultimately affect adversely neurodevelopmental outcomes during adolescence. The team involves some long-term ISRP investigators, myself and Mike Duffel, but we brought in John Dorn and Hannah Stevens and Donna Hammond with various expertise to accomplish these aims. The first aim is really an in vitro aim, looking mechanistically how these human-relevant metabolites, not the rat metabolites, the human-relevant metabolites, how they're actually affecting toxic outcome in these primary cells from rats versus the parent compounds and potentially mixtures identified by other projects. We're going to look in AIM2 kind of in parallel. Is there actually biotransformation occurring of the compounds of interest that we're studying? And then take that into an in vivo model to actually look at region-specific, so brain region-specific metabolism of PCBs, and probably more importantly, their metabolites, and ultimately how that links then in AIM3, how these metabolites actually result in adverse behavioral outcomes in adolescent rats, and then the underlying biochemical changes that we would expect based on AIM2. So the second project, as I indicated, really focuses on metabolic syndrome and how airborne PCBs and inhalation, specifically inhalation exposure to these PCBs affects metabolic syndrome by targeting the adipose tissue, by changing how pre-adipocytes differentiate the adipocytes and how that exposure also changes the function of the adipose tissue in itself, which is, you know, an endocrine tissue, and we know very little about what that does in particular during adolescence. We have preliminary data from human studies that support that there is a role between PCB exposure and, for example, diabetes. And the team that leads this effort, you know, have very nice preliminary data showing that really PCBs target the adipose tissue. So it's not just the storage site, it's actually a target site for PCB toxicity. And that not only the parent compound, but again, the metabolites are affecting toxic outcomes here. The team is led by Al Klingelholz and James Ankrum. And again, looks at the hypothesis that the PCBs and their metabolites contribute to the development of metabolic syndrome. They have a very nice human adipocyte organoid culture system that they've developed that really looks like human adipose tissue, so they can very nicely in AIM1 study the functional consequences of the PCB exposure, including the metabolites, and then they're going to go into a more complex, more real-life-like system, looking at how the liver and the adipose tissue interact with each other to, again, change adipose tissue function. And then they're going to take this into an in vivo model looking at airborne PCB exposure on essentially outcomes regarding to adiposity and metabolism. So one of the key things with these two projects is that we're really very well integrated because we're looking at adolescents. And what we've decided to do is we divide up the work a little bit. So project two will actually perform purview to perform the nose-only inhalation exposures to PCBs, which has been established, you know, in previous funding cycles, so we can do that. And we will share tissues across both projects to address our specific questions. And then in project one, we'll actually look at the exposures to the human-relevant metabolites and, again, share across projects and ultimately are then able to integrate across these animal studies. A lot of the research that we have proposed has been really informed by Project 3, which we just commonly refer as the ASOP study, Airborne Exposures to Semivolatile Organic Pollutants. This is a human cohort study that assesses PCB exposures in school children and their mothers, both in rural Iowa and in northwest Indiana, in the urban areas there. We have a tremendous amount of samples that have been banked over the last 10 years, but we also have an incredibly rich congener-specific data set of not only the PCB exposures of the study participants, but also the homes, the schools, and the outdoor environments that we can ultimately integrate. And so going forward, and Carrie indicated this, we're really interested in is what is really the relative contribution of inhalation versus dietary exposures in these individuals. not kind of overall, but specifically, ultimately, in the individuals that are exposed. So here's the hypothesis of this team that's led by Peter Thorne and involves Dr. Martinez and Dr. Merrick. Looks really at the hypothesis that both inhalation and dietary exposure to these PCBs is associated with essentially a whole range of endpoints that ultimately are informed to some extent by projects 1 and 2, what we're looking at, and by the literature by and large. So they're continuing to collect and enroll study participants, collect and analyze the relevant data. They will do a personal exposure characterization in the study participants, divvy out what's inhalation, what is diet, and you'll hear about this is, you know, again, something where we're integrating across projects. They will use a new novel approach to actually do a time-integrated personal exposures of the study participants, so we know what each child in this cohort is actually exposed to and how that differs maybe from the mother, and then ultimately modeling the exposures in the human context. Here's kind of an outline of how the workflow of the study. Again, these are child-mother pairs in East Chicago in Indiana or in two communities in Iowa. Again, this is centered around the school, so we actually have information about the indoor and outdoor air in these various locations. We have biological samples of these individuals and very rich data sets from various questionnaires, including dietary questionnaires, that will allow us to actually, in the next funding cycle, divvy apart what is inhalation exposure to PCBs and what is really the classical dietary exposure. With that, I will turn over to Carrie to then talk about the engineering projects.
Thank you, Hans. Project 4 is an engineering project that examines the sources of airborne PCBs. This is a project that I lead. We conduct field research using novel sampling and analytical methods, addressing both aerophores and non-aerophores. So the long-term goal of this project is to identify the sources of airborne PCBs and to prioritize their removal as a function of their magnitude, exposure to children, proximity to large populations, and economic feasibility of their removal. The project will include the design of air samplers that use high surface area carbon nanofibers that allow for a variety of applications, including the rapid collection of airborne PCBs in many rooms of a school simultaneously, and the capture of airborne PCB conjugates emitted from objects. This project will use computational modeling of airflow to predict the relationship between emissions and concentration and apply those predictions at the scale of a room and at the community scale. So we address two of the most important situations. Now, living and working in a school that contains PCBs in the building materials and consumer products, and living near a PCB-contaminated surface water site. So in the past, these cartoons represent four major projects that reflect the approach that this project takes. You can see in the top left, here we go. There we go, is a cartoon describing a study we reported in the EST&T letters that was our study of New Bedford Harbor. We found that New Bedford Harbor, which is heavily contaminated with PCBs and a Superfund site, is a major emission source of airborne PCBs and results in elevated concentrations to people that live nearby, which together with our collaborators at the Boston University SRP, we've shown poses elevated health risks to the communities living nearby. This was an underestimated exposure route for this site, as primarily the remediation efforts are designed around exposure through fish. So our center is showing that the importance of considering emissions to air is part of remediation decisions. Down in the below is a description of studies that we've done to look at the emissions of PCBs from modern paint. We purchase paint at a local hardware store, and we design the sampling system to measure directly the PCBs that are released from paint, and discovered that there are PCB contours released as a function of the color of the paint, because PCBs are byproducts of the chemical manufacturing of brightly colored pigments. So unfortunately, this contributes to the concentrations of PCBs that we have measured in home and in outdoor air. We've also shown that emissions from polymers applied to surfaces indoors releases PCBs. We found a unique set signature of three PCB conjugates that are released from recently installed kitchen cabinets. It's a result of the sealants that are used, and unfortunately, they were manufactured in a way that inadvertently produced PCBs. These end up being significant sources of PCBs in new construction. And the bottom has a cartoon from the table contents figure for a study. We examined PCBs in schools, indoors and outdoors, and found in the two school systems and six schools we examined, indoor air is much higher than outside air, and it seems to be a function of mixed exposure due to aerochores, which contributes to the highest level, but also modern products. So our overall hypothesis is that PCB emissions are a function of the properties of PCBs, the environmental variables, and emission surfaces. And measurement of emissions and concentrations enables cost-effective decisions for their removal. So we will be developing novel passive sampling materials for fast measurements of airborne PCBs. We will be identifying specific sources of airborne PCBs within schools and homes to identify objects that could be removed and reduce exposures. And we'll be characterizing emissions from contaminated waters nationwide using existing data and a modeling approach to predict dispersion into the communities surrounding them. The Project 5 is our second environmental engineering and science project, and it addresses the mitigation of airborne PCB emissions from sediments. So as I mentioned before, contaminated sediments are a major reservoir of PCBs and are effectively a pump for emissions of airborne PCBs from surface waters. Project 5, then, leads research related to that intervention and remediation and reduction of exposure to airborne PCBs by going after the PCBs and sediments that are most likely or will be ultimately released to the air above it. This project will be developing and testing combinations of novel sorptive reactive black carbon materials containing microbial PCB degradation films shown to degrade lower molecular weight PCBs that are likely to be released to air. So this project is led by Tim Mattis with co-investigators Jerry Schnoor, Andres Martinez, and Greg Lefebvre, all in the Department of Civil Environmental Engineering and associated with IIHR Hydroscience and Engineering. The hypothesis of this study is that novel tailored black carbon materials containing PCB degrading biofilms will enhance biodegradation of PCBs in contaminated sediments, and that will result in lower PCB emissions from these sediments. We'll be optimizing the black carbon for sorptive and reactive properties. They'll be evaluating those materials containing aerobic PCB degrading biofilms in order to lower PCB concentrations in water and air under relevant environmental conditions. And then they'll be scaling up production to demonstrate the feasibility of decreasing airborne PCB fluxes from contaminated sediments at the mesocosm scale. Studies that are ongoing and will continue in this project for material development and testing are shown here. On the left is a Solvgel encapsulated biochar materials that this group has created. And this is an image of close-up of that porous Solvgel that can then develop the biofilm support that degrade PCBs. And on the right is a schematic of the mesocosms that they will be examining that look at the release of PCBs under the different materials added, amended to the sediments, and the impact on the flux from the sediment to the water and to the air. The disks at the top are the same materials that Project 4 and Project 3 are using to sample PCBs and made of nanofibers. So
Terry, I do apologize for interrupting. I just see a lot of questions coming through the Q&A pod, and I want you to make sure you have time to get to them. So just kind of a quick time check.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michelle. What time do we need to wrap up for our part of this presentation?
Well, we only have 5 minutes left for questions, so if you could just maybe go through the next couple of slides rather quickly.
Okay, so we only have till 2:20.
Yes.
Okay, great. So I will skip.
But that includes questions, Carrie.
Yes, I will skip through this description of the materials. You can see this later. This is the overall view of our center. We have a very important research support course that allows us to do the work that we do. In particular, I want to note the synthesis course that Dr. Lehmler leads, and I lead the analytical core. And these two cores provide the material and the analytical instrumentation and methods in order for us to be able to measure PCBs and all of the metabolites associated with it, as well as provide the materials for the animal experiments, laboratory experiments, including the sediments. So we also have a data management and analysis core that is very important for our center, and one of the most important parts about it is it provides an integrative approach to interpreting our data so that we can share our data and findings to synergize to the overall goals that we have about remediation decision making. So I'm going to skip through this because I do want to get to the questions, and this is my last slide, and just want to note that our center is designed to address the SRP mandates, assessment of emerging concern of airborne PCBs, including the effects of airborne PCBs on human health, the risk assessment for airborne PCBs, detection of airborne PCBs in a variety of environments, and reduction of airborne PCBs. We really appreciate the engagement of our stakeholders, and I'm sorry I can't talk more about that, but I'm very interested to see what kind of questions we have. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry, Carrie and Hans, for having to cut you short, but I want you to be able to get to the questions. So here they go. So this one, I believe, is referring to Project 1. And the question was, this is kind of a nitty-gritty question. Where was 4'95 PCB metabolite measured in human? In what tissue or fluid?
So I believe I stated this. We actually, at least to my knowledge, there's no published data out looking at hydroxylated or other metabolites in actually human postmortem tissue. So all the information we have is essentially a handful of laboratory studies in rodents that are essentially coming from my laboratory, with a few others maybe out there here and there and whales and some other species. So we actually do not know if that particular hydroxylated metabolite actually is in the human brain.
Okay, thank you, Hans, for clarification. The next question is, are PCB compounds that may generate the relevant human metabolites found in environmental media?
I'm going to think that's a question for both Hans and I. We do measure PCB breakdown products in the environment, including those that are metabolites of in the human. However, the sources in the environment are unclear. Some are found as a result of the original manufacturing and contamination of aerophores. Some are a result of microbial activity in the environment, some are a result of atmospheric reactions, and some are discharges from wastewater treatment plants.
Okay, and I've got two more questions I'm going to try to squeeze in at the risk of missing the rest of them. I'm sorry, everybody. Next one is, how are airborne PCB environmental exposures presented to human receptors as particulates or volatiles from contaminated soil to air or contaminated surface water to air?
So actually, the experimental approach we've adopted in the Superfund, in the ISRP, is to do a nose-only inhalation so that they're actually inhaling the vapor of the respective individual PCB congeners or PCB mixtures.
Yes, that's very important because in the environment, 90% of the airborne PCBs or more are in the gas phase. Contrary to our historical expectations, airborne PCBs are not associated with particulate matter as much as they are at gas phase, and that's true for all the PCBs, not just the lower molecular weight PCBs. Even PCB 209 is semi-volatile, and we have measured it in the gas phase.
Okay, thank you, Carrie and Hans. Okay, last quick question. Once PCBs are in the body, are there any therapeutic measures that can reduce their concentration?
Well, that's a good question. There have been some really remarkable studies using synthetic fat, olestra, to extract PCBs from people who are contaminated. And there was an idea for a while about using those olestra potato chips to do so. And there's also been some remarkable studies about the effect of losing weight on how PCBs are remobilized in the body. But I do think that there's a great deal that is yet to be understood about how the human body metabolizes PCBs, in part because of the lack of understanding of PCB metabolites. A great deal of previous work has examined just the parent and the disappearance of the parent without fully understanding the route to the metabolic products of PCBs, an area of focus of our center.
Okay, thank you, Carrie. And just before we leave you to move on to LSU, I wanted to make sure I pointed out a nice comment that came through the Q&A, and that is a thank you for studying New Bedford. The community members need as much data as possible.
That's great. We care about that very much, too.
Okay, so next up, we have Louisiana State University SRP Center. So we have three presenters from that center. The first one is Dr. Stefania Cormier. She serves as director of the Louisiana State, or LSU, Superfund Research Program Center. She is the leader of the administration core and leads the biomedical research project entitled Environmentally Persistent Free Radicals Alter Pulmonary Immunologic Homeostasis. Her research specialization is understanding how early exposure or exposures impact respiratory health. Cormier is a principal investigator of two other NIH grants. Also speaking for LSU, we're going to hear from Dr. Tammy Dukas, who is the leader of the Research Experience and Training Coordination Corps for the LSU SRP Center and leads the biomedical project investigating the role of exposure to environmentally persistent free radicals in promoting endothelial dysfunction. Her toxicological research focuses on the role of environmental exposures in the induction or exacerbation of vascular diseases, including atherosclerosis and pulmonary hypertension. And finally, we'll hear from Dr. Jennifer Richmond Bryant, who leads the Exposure Assessment Project for the LSU SRP Center and is co-leader of the Community Engagement Corps. She is an associate professor of the practice in the North Carolina State University Department of Forestry and Environmental Health Resources, or Environmental Resources. Her research specialization is human exposure to air pollution with a particular emphasis on the influence of exposure variability on interpretation of epidemiological study results and air pollution in underserved communities. I will now turn it over to Dr. Cormier.
Good afternoon. Can everybody hear me?
We sure can.
Today I'm going to be talking to you. Thank you. Today I'm going to be talking to you about the LSU Superfund Research Center. This research center is actually a large aggregation, basically, of a number of universities, each brought together with specific expertise to address this complex exposure pollutant system. So environmentally persistent free radicals, or EPFRs as we call them, are pollutant molecules that are formed as a complex sort of mixture. This mixture consists of organics, metal oxides, and a particle substrate, and these come together to form a chemisorbed species that creates a persistent, stable free radical. And it does that by this chemisorption process. In addition, we call these environmentally persistent free radicals because when people think of free radicals, their first thought is that a free radical lasts for, you know, a millisecond or less than a millisecond. These radicals actually persist for longer than that. And so what's shown here on the right, sorry, I will grab my little pointer. What's shown here on the right is actually that environmentally persistent free radicals that we've captured in the air around the Baton Rouge area, which represents air coming from industrialized Superfund sites. And what you can see is that using this electroparamagnetic resonance spectroscopy, we can actually measure the radical content present on the particulate matter collected from the air. And so this peak and trough actually represents the amount of radicals present, and the width of this actually represents the type of radicals present. But what's important for you to notice is that from day 0 to day 54, these radicals are still persistent on these same particle species. And the half-life of this radical that was collected at this time was actually something like 21 days. So we've been doing a tremendous amount of work in the past few decades demonstrating that EPFRs are pollutant particle systems that are formed during combustion processes, and they are formed and produced during thermal treatment of hazardous waste found at Superfund sites, or hazardous waste that are being degraded or remediated at sites external to Superfund sites. Currently, 30% of all Superfund sites still use thermal treatment of waste to dispose of their waste, except for groundwater remediation processes. And finally, EPFRs are an understudied contaminant, and they have a huge potential to impact human health. This is a map of Louisiana, and it shows several Superfund sites that are currently capable of producing EPFRs during their remediation processes. And it also shows sites where EPFRs were produced during cleanup processes, and that's shown here. In addition, it shows sites where hazardous waste incinerators exist, and you can see Louisiana has a number of hazardous waste incinerators scattered throughout the state. These hazardous waste incinerators typically remediate waste through thermal treatment processes and are capable of emitting EPFRs into the environment. And what I've done is tried to highlight two different areas where we're working with the communities to understand potential exposures and health-associated risk associated with those communities. And Dr. Jennifer Richmond Bryant will talk to you about Colfax, and then this is Allison, which is in North Baton Rouge Parish. When we started studying EPFRs, there were very few papers that realized that these were actually a complex molecule that was chemisorbed as one particular species. And everybody was typically looking at whether or not the metal was responsible for the health effect, or was it the organic that was responsible for the health effect, or was it the particle itself that was responsible for the health effect? And what Dr. Barry Dellinger realized was that it's the mixture of these three things and this entity that it forms, which we call EPFRs, that is actually responsible for some of the effects that we're seeing. And at least in our animal systems and some of the human data that we're starting to get, seems to be important in the health-associated effects. On the right, I'm showing you the sum of citations that cite LSU Superfund research, EPFR research. And you can see that from 2000 to present, we've had a tremendous increase in the number of papers that cite our research, along with other papers that are starting to come out demonstrating the presence of EPFRs in the environment and their potential health effects. In addition, we've summarized some important findings recently demonstrating that EPFRs are this newly realized class of pollutants. And in certain papers, such as this policy paper, we discuss the potential for them to form on pristine engineered nanomaterials, which is a new area where we see their formation. And because we lack the basic data and fundamental knowledge of how EPFRs are formed and how they interact and how they impact health, we're at a considerable disadvantage to studying these. And so our research is critical in trying to identify these basic mechanisms. So as I mentioned, our Superfund research program studies environmentally persistent free radicals. These are pollutants that are associated with the remediation of hazardous wastes. And so they can be found at Superfund sites where thermal remediation processes are occurring, or they can be found at sites where hazardous wastes are being remediated external to Superfund sites. The goal of our research is to clarify the pulmonary and cardiovascular effects associated with inhalation exposure to these EPFRs, to understand what community exposures are, especially in light of socioeconomic stressors and other stressors such as noise, and then to understand how these EPFRs are formed. Because if we can figure out how they're formed and how they're stabilized, then we can develop methods to actually destroy them or prevent them from being formed in the first place. Now, part of the Superfund research program is not just to do the basic science research behind all of this, but also to be able to develop a workforce that's capable of dealing with these complex exposures and to address these complex research questions, which involve things from health effects to scientific, to engineering and chemistry and physical type effects and research. And so we train future scientists to deal with these broad research topics, and then we collaborate with communities that are either impacted by these or want to understand what they might be exposed to. And then we translate our findings to these communities to help them to support their collective actions should there be exposures within those communities. And Dr. Richmond Bryant will talk about this, and Dr. Dugas will talk about training our future scientists. So this is the structure of our Superfund research program. We have a number of different cores, and those cores support all of the research activities that are shown down here. We have a cohort of environmental science and engineering projects, and we go from physics all the way to community exposures, which sort of bridges the gaps with the biomedical research projects. In the cores, we have the community engagement core, which is driven by Margaret Reams. Many of the community people, if they're online, know Margaret. She's a fantastic community engagement person. Dr. Dugas is going to talk to you about our training. We have a data management analysis core driven by Don Mercante out of the LSU Health Sciences Center in New Orleans. We have an inhalation core that helps us with our exposures in vivo and in vitro, and that's driven by Dr. Alexandra Noel, and a materials core that helps generate particles, EPFR particles that we can actually study in the lab that are very defined and characterized, and also characterized as field samples that we bring in from our community studies. And that's driven by Dr. Labrie. Dr. Sprunger is a physicist. He's studying the molecular structure and decay of EPFRs, and we'll talk to you about his project in a little bit. Dr. Lomnicki looks at how these are formed and how these generate hydroxyl radicals in biological solutions, and you'll hear from Dr. Richmond Bryant in a second, and you'll hear from Dr. Dugas. Dr. Dugas studies cardiovascular function, and my project, along with Dr. Wayne Backus from the LSU Health Sciences Center in New Orleans and Dr. Peter Sly from the University of Queensland, is to understand how exposure to EPFRs impacts pulmonary function and to bridge the gap between animal models and humans through cohorts that Peter and Dr. Sly has access to in Australia. So this is basically to show you what we study and why we try to study it. So this is an airway, and this is an airway of an animal that is actually just exposed to saline. And you can see that there's these nice open alveolar spaces that are blown up here. This is what the lung is supposed to look like. However, if you have an asthmatic lung, the lung doesn't look like this. You have a thickening of the airway walls. You have a subepithelial fibrosis that occurs over time. And then you have this recruitment of cells, which is shown here. And these cells are basically what we call inflammation. So this is an inflamed lung because it's having an allergic response. Now, these lungs, when they're in the presence of an environmental pollutant such as an EPFR, become worsened. So there's the inflammation becomes worse. The subepithelial fibrosis becomes worse and the airway epithelium becomes destroyed. And this increased inflammation is what we were interested in studying. Now, I study asthma in a variety of models, including allergic models, and typically those types of asthma are driven by a certain type of cell called a T helper 2 cell, and it's eosinophil mediated. But what we saw when we exposed animals to EPFRs was that this type of asthma was not eosinophil mediated. It was actually mediated by a group of cells called neutrophils. And neutrophils are typically driven by a different type of T helper cell called a TH17 or a T helper 17 cell. And these TH17 cells induce a type of asthma that's associated with neutrophils in the airways and is responsible for a steroid insensitive asthma, which means this is harder to treat and it's more severe and it's more fatal because we can't treat it as well. And so Project One is aimed at figuring out why we develop these TH17 immune responses. And we have some ideas that all focus on this one molecule called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. And we believe that EPFRs induce reactive oxygen species and that this alters the ligands that are present for this receptor and causes it to produce these TH17 cells. And that's what we're going to study in our project. Now, that's my aim of the project. Dr. Backus's aim of the project is looking at aryl hydrocarbon receptor driven proteins called CYPs. And these things are actually involved in metabolism of certain products within the body. And because they're involved in metabolism of certain products of the body, they can actually alter ligands for the aryl hydrocarbon receptor and affect whether or not they can produce these TH17 type cells. So we're studying here and here and why these impact this. And then Dr. Peter Sly is actually taking this from animal models into humans to show whether or not we see TH17-mediated asthma phenotypes in human pediatric cohorts, and whether we can actually trace it back by geocoding these kids and finding out what they're exposed to find out whether EPFR exposures are actually driving these responses in human populations. And that's just summarized here. So our hypothesis is that EPFRs modulate aryl hydrocarbon receptor signaling, and that alters the immune response leading to the steroid-insensitive asthma, and it does that through aryl hydrocarbon receptor activity. And we study the mechanisms in animal models, in cell models, and then in humans we look to demonstrate the link between these exposures and poor respiratory health in children. Specifically, is this neutrophil and TH17 mediated? Now, one of the first questions we had to ask, and this is the only other data I'm going to show you on Project One, is what cells actually in the lung are responding to these EPFRs? And you can imagine from the other slide, there's a large number of cells in the lungs. There are immune cells in the lung, there are epithelial cells in the lung, there are smooth muscle cells in the lung, there are vascular cells in the lung. So to answer this question wasn't a small question. It was actually really important. And so what we did was use highly complex flow cytometry to do this. And here we're using spectral flow cytometry. And what we're looking at is each of these dots actually represents an individual different cell in the lung. And what we show is that there are certain cells that are capable of responding to EPFR exposure. And these other cells are not responding to EPFR exposure. And so what we then do is look at whether or not we can define what these cells are, and we can. And so on the right, what we're showing is the cells that are responding. And one of the first things we noticed was that if you look at this figure here, this is saline-exposed female mice, and you can see that there's the expression of this protein, CYP1A1, which is a marker for aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation, is typically here. So unexposed looks like this. And then when you expose them, the types of cells that are responding change, and these become the cells that are responding. Now, this is interesting because while the females respond like that, the males don't respond. So males, whether they're exposed to EPFRs or not, have very little change in the cells that are responding to those EPFRs. Now, if you look at the individual cell population, so here what we've got is macrophages, type 2 alveolar epithelial cells, and then other cells in the lung, such as ciliated cells, club cells, mucus-producing cells, or type 1 cells. You can then define the populations that are actually expressing and responding to after exposure. And what we found is that the cells that are responding are club cells, ciliated cells, mucous cells, and type 2 cells. And this is important for some of Dr. Dugas' work that she's going to present in a second. Tammy?
Okay, so project 2 is focused on understanding the cardiovascular risks of EPR exposures and builds upon some pioneering work in our Superfund Research Center driven by Dr. Kurt Varner at the LSU Health Sciences Center. So his pioneering study showed that 5 days exposure to EPRs led to, in experimental animals, a decrease in heart function, so a decrease in cardiac output, and also a decrease in filling of the left ventricle. So here. So he tried to understand how or why there was a decrease in filling in the left ventricle, and what he found in follow-up studies was that the decreased filling was a result of not really a heart effect at all, but a decrease or an increase, I'm sorry, in pulmonary arterial pressure. So an increased resistance to flow in the pulmonary artery led to a decrease in left ventricular filling and therefore a decrease in cardiac output. And all of this was associated with an oxidative stress response in the left ventricle. And so in normal animals, when you remove the EPR exposures, in healthy animals, these animals were just fine and heart function returns to normal. But when in other animals, he experimentally induced a myocardial infarction or heart attack, the animals were less able to compensate. And so what that could mean is that in an exposed population where there is a significant amount of air pollution, heart attacks could have much more deadly consequences. And so based upon his findings that decreases in heart function were a function of an increase in pulmonary arterial pressures, our overarching hypothesis was that the primary target of EPR exposures in the cardiovascular system was actually the vasculature and not the heart itself. And so shown here in this diagram is our central hypothesis. Our hypothesis was that an EPR exposure results in lung injury and aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation in the lung that then leads to a release of mediators, small biomolecules into the systemic circulation or blood that in turn results in some sort of vascular dysfunction, and that vascular dysfunction in turn results in cardiovascular disease initiation. It's been shown previously that the endothelial cells that line the inner layer of the vascular wall or an intermittent contact with the circulation are critical to maintaining vascular homeostasis. And so what they normally do is prevent the injury of inflammatory cells and cholesterol into the vessel wall, and they also produce nitric oxide to maintain a relaxed state, so to maintain blood flow through the tissue. But when they become dysfunctional, you got the entry of inflammatory cells and entry of cholesterol so that the vessel wall becomes thickened, and the artery is less able to dilate, and so the end result is cardiovascular disease initiation and decreased oxygenation of tissues. So our working hypotheses are illustrated here in our AIMS, and our AIMS 1 and 2 were meant to test the working hypothesis that the lung aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation after inhalation of EPRs resulted in a physiologic change in the cardiovascular system, AIM 1 in the heart, and increases in pulmonary vascular resistance, and AIM 2 in the vessels themselves, resulting in a decrease in vascular function. So in AIM 1, we're looking at physiologic mechanisms, and AIM 2, we dive deeper into cellular mechanisms. And in specific AIM 3, we test the hypothesis that the small molecules that are being released into the circulation are actually oxidized lipids formed in the lung through oxidative stress. So to test these hypotheses required that we interface to two really important cores, and that was the materials core and the inhalation toxicology core. So the materials core, run by Dr. Labrie at LSU, has been doing some pioneering work in the development of new particle systems for studying EPRs. What's important in biologic studies that assess risk of EPR exposures is trying to tease apart the importance of the free radical compared to the importance of the other components of that mixture we refer to as particulate matter. So what was critically important for us was some environmentally relevant control that had less free radical content. Building upon some data generated years ago in the Dellinger Laboratory, who was the first director of our Superfund Center, they were able to do that. They've created for us two types of particle systems, one that contains high levels of free radicals, we call those F for high, and particles that contain low amounts of free radicals, which we refer to as F for low. And that data that they built upon was data that showed that within a combustion reactor, the ECFRs are actually formed in cool zones within the flame or cool pockets. And so by collecting particles in two different zones within a combustion reactor, they can generate particles with both high concentrations of free radical. You can see the EPR spectrum shown here. Our F for high are represented by the red trace, so very large amount of free radicals, compared to our F for lows in the black trace that have smaller amounts of free radicals. In fact, they contain 100 times less free radical content. We also interfaced with our inhalation toxicology core, directed by Dr. Alexandra Noel, to develop an exposure system, a whole body inhalation system, that was able to achieve whole body exposures, but in a very small footprint. So despite that we can generate particulate matter containing EPFRs, it's still tough to generate a super amount of them, and so we still needed an inhalation chamber that had a small footprint. So Dr. Noel went to work to generate something that was capable of dry particle aerosolization of EPFRs, and to do that she used a Venturi system to direct those dry particles into the chamber. Just before introduction into the chamber, they're diluted with filtered air. And they're directed into the chamber, and the mice generally sit at the bottom of this chamber down here. And so one of the things I want to point out is what we can also do is through one inlet here on the right, we can measure real-time particle concentrations by placing a dust track system there. And on the left-hand side, we have another outlet for measuring, gravimetrically measuring total particle concentrations over an entire exposure period, and we do that by placing a filter across that outlet. And so our exposures are generally 4 hours a day, and we generally expose for one day, 3 days, or 10 days. Our inhalation toxicology core also used transmission electron microscopy to characterize our particles, and they're demonstrating that we get a little bit of a heterogeneous mix of particles that range between 50 nanometers and 200 nanometers, so definitely within the nanoparticle range. And so this slide just highlights some of our early data. So we've actually conducted a large amount of gene expression analyses. I'm highlighting here just three genes that highlight the bulk of our findings. As early as one day after an exposure, we began to get a dose-dependent increase in gene expression in the lung. And I'm summarizing here on the left-hand side, CYP1A1 and 1B1 expression, which are signatures for aryl hydrocarbon activation. And then on the right-hand side, dose-dependent increases in NQO1 expression, which is prototypical of an antioxidant response when there is an oxidative stress in a tissue. The body responds by elevating its antioxidant response. So it suggests to us that, yes, there is an aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation in the lung, and there is also oxidative stress. We also looked at gene expression changes in aorta, which is a very large vessel, but downstream of the lung. And we see similar signatures, albeit to a lesser extent. We were kind of scratching our heads about this one. It could mean that some of those particles, especially the smaller ones, are getting loose into the circulation. And then this is the last data slide I'll show you. We're diving deeper into molecular mechanisms or cellular mechanisms, and so we began to look at where lung cells interface very well with cells of the vascular system, and that's at the air-blood interface. So I'm illustrating on the left-hand side alveoli and alveolar spaces that represent the air-blood interface. So you'll see here that at the air-blood interface within alveoli, there are a large number of capillaries, and capillaries contain capillary endothelial cells. They're also intimately associated with cells like type 2 pneumocytes, which have already been highlighted by Dr. Cormier as a cell type that elevates its aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation after an EPFR exposure. Research has documented that those two cell types engage and interact physiologically, so our working hypothesis was that aryl hydrocarbon receptor activation in the type 2 pneumocyte leads to the release of mediators into the circulation via that exchange or interaction with those capillary, tiny capillaries within alveoles at the air-blood interface to induce a vascular effect. And then finally, just to highlight one study that we're working on, we were able to generate animal models that are selectively deficient in aryl hydrocarbon receptor as in the type 2 pneumocytes using a Cre recombinase system. And as you can see here, in wild-type animals and knockout animals are selectively deficient in type 2 pneumocyte AHR. When we expose these animals for as little as one day to EPFRs, we see a dose-dependent increase in, I'm showing here, plasma endothelin 1, which is a potent vasoconstricting agent. And we usually find that elevations in endothelin 1 are coupled very tightly with decreases in vasodilation. So dose-dependent increases in endothelin 1 levels, and the animals for which AT2 or endothelial cell type 2 AHR is deficient, we see that those animals are protected. So these are very early findings, and ongoing studies are looking at changes in physiology. We'll keep you posted on that. Next, I'll hand it over to Dr. Jennifer Richmond Bryant, who will tell you about some of the other projects.
Great. Thank you, Tammy. Can you guys hear me?
Jen? Yes, we certainly yes. can. And I apologize for having to interrupt you, but I am looking toward the time, and I am cognizant that there are some questions that came through the Q&A, and I want to make sure you guys have time for that. So to the extent you can go through these as quickly as you can, I'm sorry to have to ask you to do that.
All right. So Project 3 and the Community Engagement Corps have been working hand-in-hand to roll out our field study in Colfax, Louisiana. So Colfax is home to an open burn, open detonation, hazardous waste disposal site. You can see that on the right. They take waste from military sites, Superfund sites, and fireworks from places like Disneyland. A local community organization called the Central Louisiana Coalition for a Clean and Healthy Environment approached LSU a few years ago about taking air measurements, and we're working together with them to create a community-engaged sampling approach. The Community Engagement Corps has been facilitating that portion of the work while Project 3 focuses on data gathering. And the LaCares model, which is featured in the forefront of the slide, is a model developed by Professor Margaret Ream to facilitate information sharing and mitigation actions across the community. So Project 3 is working to characterize conditions in Colfax. I'm not going to read these for you in the interest of time, but the first aim really centers around working with the community to ascertain what they've been experiencing before going in and taking air sampling measurements. We use the insights we gain from the community to inform our ambient air sampling protocols, and then we're also going to be doing some in-home work to try to capture concentrations of EPFRs in dust, as well as looking at other chemical species. So the Community Engagement Corps has been facilitating a number of different meetings. We have biweekly meetings with our partners from the Colfax community, as well as the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. We've also held external advisory board meetings as well to get input from a number of players, and these have included citizens of Colfax. There have also been a number of environmental health literacy activities that have been going on in tandem to support the Superfund community participation in the site decisions. to update the Louisiana Citizens Guide to Environmental Engagement, and then to develop a new course in community-engaged research as well in partnership with Southern University, one of our many partners. So just to give you an idea of the data gathering work we've been doing around Colfax for AIM-1, and we have completed a good portion of this work over the last year remotely, which I can talk about another time. But basically, we've been using a combination of oral history interviews and public comments. You can see a picture from those public comments in the center of the slide of Henry Moore. He shows his arm, which if you look closely, there are some nasty scars from, we think, deposited material. You can see a quote on the right of the screen by another resident, Rebecca Lonadier. One thing that really struck me, and it was just mind-boggling, is so many people with thyroid problems. Everybody has thyroid problems. So we use insights like that, as well as self-reported observation of smoke, noise, vibration, damage to home, self-reported health problems, including thyroid, skin, respiratory, heart, and gastrointestinal problems, as well as the addresses to map where there have been problems, what kinds of issues that people have complained about, and we're using that to set up our sampling plan. And so we have a plan to do a number of, to deploy a number of different types of measurements, including high volume air pollution sampling. We're going to use low cost sensors in conjunction with those to report concentrations back to the community so that they can have an idea of when there are peaks. In addition, we're using a dense array of passive samplers to really try to do a careful study on the composition of the material that that is being released into the community. The Data Management Core has been doing a lot of work to support our efforts, including setting up a database for our app that we're developing to report that information back to the community on concentrations. Project 4, moving right along, is actually projects 4 and 5, I should say, are both designed to understand formation and deactivation of the EPFRs, but in different ways. I'm not going to read through all of the aims, but I do want to just highlight a few things. Aim 1 of Project 4 seeks to build from previous research showing what starts off the EPFR reaction cycle, and we're testing what environmental conditions, such as acidity, might affect EPFR reaction rates and intensity. Aim 2 is about to begin. It's looking at what compounds may suppress EPFR formation and where in the reaction cycle that might be most effective. And then Aim 3 is focused around developing, testing, and deploying sensors that could be used on a community basis specifically for EPFRs. And then Project 5, which is being led by Phil Sprunger. Project 4, by the way, is Professor Slavo Lomnicki. But Project 5 is focused around understanding the molecular structure of EPFRs to understand how they're formed and decayed. I actually am reading, and I skipped over the materials core, which has been supporting our laboratory efforts to test methods to deactivate EPFRs, just like it's been supporting our biochemical testing. But anyway, for Project 5, we're focused around understanding molecular structure of EPFRs and how they are formed and decayed, and we think that understanding these processes will guide us to develop schemes to neutralize EPFRs once they're formed to reduce their dangerous health effects. And with that, I am going to pass it back to Dr. Duga to talk a little bit about our training core before we wrap up.
Okay, so our training core has been active all through the shutdown. We've met every Wednesday for the last semester. We've gotten underway all of our training programs, including responsible conduct research. We're learning about rigor and reproducibility of data and didactic things like environmental communication and best practices therein, and methods for environmental justice research. We just completed our journal club, which led to very lively discussions of some critical papers in environmental health research. And then finally, I'm excited to tell you about the annotation project. We couldn't, our trainees couldn't get into communities themselves. We couldn't interact directly with high school teachers and high school students as we had proposed. So we decided to develop a tool for our tool chest. They are annotating a journal article, and they're trying to bring a journal article in environmental science down to a ninth grade level by using little things that they can click within the article that contain glossary items, YouTube videos, Wikipedia pages, links to news and other things that can make a journal article understandable at a ninth grade level. And we are working with a couple of teachers to get those implemented into classrooms in the spring semester. And we're hoping that we can, again, use that as a tool next year when we try to get into communities. We're hoping that by engaging teachers and high school students, we can make bigger impacts and bigger strides in the communities that we serve. And I think that's it.
Thank you very much, Steph, Tammy, and Jen. And I know you had to go through this really quickly, and I'm sorry. And we are just out of time, and I have a few things that I need to say. What I've done is I put through the chat box just links to the directly to the center's web pages if you guys are interested. I know we didn't get a chance to go to all the questions today. I did want to ask one question that came through the chat pod to LSU, and that is a question about, do efforts exist in nature, or are they only formed as a result of human activity?
I'm going to answer that. This is Steph, and actually they also exist in nature. So we can find them in the soils. We're not sure if they're just around soils from Superfund sites or they're at soils throughout the U.S. or globally, but we definitely find them being formed on clays, and we think that they're actually de novo formed on clays without remediation processes at Superfund sites. They just form at a lot lower levels.
Thank you, Steph. And
does that help?
Yes, yes. We do have more questions, and we will do our best to kind of connect those who ask the questions to the presenters. Again, thank you, everybody from Iowa, LSU, and NC State who took the time to present these slides today. And I think a lot of people learned about all the good research that is coming on board with your centers. We're excited to see how this goes. Now is my what I have to do is conclude this webinar, and I have a few parting thoughts and things that I want to make sure that you know about before you leave. So if you could just bear with us for maybe one more minute, I'll try to be quick. So I just wanted to make sure everyone's aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as you heard it today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you'll find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling this out. We do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanism. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I'd also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN, so CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter TechDirect and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage for more information about upcoming centers. You can also follow Superfund on Twitter, and we also have websites for all of the centers we support on our website as well. So if you're interested in any of the centers that you heard about in these last four sessions, there'll be more information for you there. So, thank you for hanging on. Thank you again to the presenters. Thank you for the great questions through the Q&A pod. I know we didn't get to all of them, but we'll do our best to follow up for the presenters. So lastly, everyone, please have a great rest of your day, and we'll sign off.